comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm. Hey there, tax fans. Welcome to State Tax Talks with me, your host, Joe Tantillo. I'm a tax attorney at the Hodgson Russ Law Firm looking to explore the nuances of state and local tax law. Here on the show, our goal is to keep tax informative, simple, and fun. So if you're ready to talk tax, turn up the volume and dive into this episode of State Tax Talks. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo. Today is a very special occasion because this is our first crossover episode with both a tax and non-tax topic. We are discussing brownfield redevelopment projects, which is a fantastic way to incentivize people to clean up hazardous sites, which being from Western New York, given our industrial history, the entire area is unfortunately one big brownfield site. That said, I'm very excited today to be joined by a friend of the show, Mr. Joe Endres, and new friend of the show, Mr. Mike Hecker. For those of you that have listened to the show before, Joe is a partner in our state and local tax group. I have given him his big, long introduction before, so no hard feelings, Joe, when I give Mike a very specialized introduction right now, because yours is out there in the on the airwaves. Mike is a graduate of the University of Buffalo Law School and is licensed to practice law in New York State. He is a partner at Hodgson Russ and the leader of the firm's environmental practice group, and he has a broad-based environmental and energy-based practice with focus on addressing environmental issues in business transactions, regulatory compliance counseling and permitting, administrative, civil, and criminal environmental defense, and remediation-based project oversight and assistance, which is exactly what we were talking about today. Mike has been named by Chambers USA as one of America's leading lawyers for business in the environment category. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Appreciate it.
Glad to have you on. And welcome back, Joe.
Ah, happy to be here.
So like I said, today we are talking about brownfield redevelopment projects, which is one part cleanup, essentially, and then one part tax credits. So it's a great first topic for us to delve into on this show. But let's start from the very beginning. I think that our listeners might be interested in hearing some of the history of the brownfield cleanup program. How did it start? What is it? Where did it come from, right?
So the brownfield cleanup program at its heart is a voluntary remedial program. And what that means is the state wants to give a means of incentivizing individuals to try and remediate impacted or blighted properties, which could be hazardous waste sites, it could be closed landfills, it could be sites impacted by various type of constituents or media. A lot of states have different programs. What the state in New York specific has done is they've married the concept of having a voluntary remedial program and incentivizing economic redevelopment. And what I mean by that is the precursor to the brownfield cleanup program was something known as the voluntary cleanup program. And in New York State, there wasn't any tax credit incentive. It was just a way to get third parties to show up to the site, clean it up, and the state would give you a limited liability release. And it did help with getting a number of sites into a program. And as a voluntary program, you don't necessarily have the state telling you what you have to do. You can work cooperatively and find a remedy that may be a little bit less restrictive than it otherwise would be. The problem that we found with that, though, is it didn't go far enough for the state. So in 2003, what they did is legislation was passed creating what's known as the Brownfield Cleanup Program in New York, which actually married the concept of going through a remedial program, cleaning up a site, giving you a limited liability release waiver known as a certificate of completion, and then on the back end, giving you tax credits for both the remediation you did as well as tax credits for any type of tangible structure you put up within 10 years after the fact. And I work with Joe on a lot of these projects. And what it does is it doesn't just result in a site being cleaned up. It results in a site being cleaned up and then put back into usable form, and often very usable form, which benefits the locality as well as the state from a tax generating perspective.
Right. This is definitely a classic instance of the legislature using the incentive of tax credits to do some good and bring some benefit. You know, Joe, you deal with the tax credit side all this time. You know, when you're talking to people about these incentives and the benefits of the programs, you know, what do you say?
Well, I say that it is very lucrative. It's a great program. In fact, the program has paid out over $3.5 billion since its inception in refundable tax credits. So it is absolutely big dollars, and there is a big nut to chase for developers, for folks cleaning the property. And what the program really does is leverages private money through the incentive program, through the incentive tax credits. So you get more bang for your buck because you know you're going to get a percentage of your cost remediating or a percentage of your cost developing the site back in the form of a tax credit.
Right. Are there other benefits outside of the tax credit? You mentioned the limited liability certificate of completion.
So the certificate of completion is really a major benefit. And often it's something that certain parties will get into the program for, notwithstanding the tax credits, just because of the long-term value and viability of having that. What it basically is a document from the state saying, we will not seek to sue or enforce against you for any contamination that you clean up on the property that's within the confines of the brownfield area and that are subject to the types of materials you cleaned up. So what does that help you do? Helps you get financing. It helps you sell the property in the future because a third party feels comfortable they're not going to be enforced against. And it buys you a level of comfort more generally that the dollars you're investing privately on the site are not being at risk. And the certificate of completion is transferable, which what that means is I could buy the site, clean it up, then transfer it to Joe, and then Joe transfers it to you, and then so on and so on. And the eighth owner still has the benefits of that certificate of completion.
Wow, that's nice peace of mind for, the buyer, X number of people down the line. So I imagine that this program is probably predominantly used by real estate developers and people in, construction.
I mean, in part, it's also used by manufacturing and industrial concerns. Mm-hmm. It's a good way to leverage tax dollars on building out. And Joe can tell you this, but if you're going to be creating manufacturing jobs as part of the program, there's actually a higher threshold. So you qualify for more tax credits because the state wants that to happen. It's also used, quite honestly, for a way for third parties to kind of leverage investment dollars. A lot of the tax credit type that's generated through this program end up being securitized or flow through different sort of entities in order to benefit third parties because you're able to leverage the value of the tax credits in different ways.
And hopefully coming soon, it'll have a bigger impact on renewable energy sites because that was a recent change to the program that hopefully, we'll see a lot more of that going forward.
Absolutely. A huge priority of New York State in particular, but you see it with the Biden administration and a number of states elsewhere, renewable energy is a great tool to place on brownfield sites mm-hmm. because you have sites that may not qualify for other certain types of redevelopment, but you know what it can be used for? It can be used for solar panels.
Yeah, you won't put a daycare there, but you'll put a solar field.
and you know what? And it works. And it, there's value there and it helps both local municipalities and customers getting cheaper energy. It's more reliable and it's putting those properties back into proper use and the municipalities are generating tax dollars off that as well.
So first iteration of the program back in 2003, and you mentioned revisions to the original brownfield program. How many versions are we at now? Is this 3.0, 4.0?
Yeah, so this is technically 4.0. The program has been revised, and each subsequent revision before this last one, before the fourth revision, from my perspective, was really a restriction of the program. All of those significantly reduced, in some fashion, the credits that ultimately would flow. Let me give you an example. In the first version of the program, you could essentially do a relatively minor or, cheap remediation and then put up a $200 million building on the site and get a whole boatload of tax credits as a result of your construction costs. So there was no proportionality, there was no connection between the amount you spent remediating and the amount you spent developing. And as a result, under that first version, the state said, whoa, we're not getting too much bang for our buck. We're paying out a boatload in tax credits for not very much remediation potentially. So they then subsequently restricted the program to tie those construction credits or those development credits to the amount that you spend remediating the site. So with each subsequent revision, the tax credits have gotten tighter, except for this fourth one, this most recent one. I actually view this most recent version as being an expansion of the program. We partially talked about the fact that renewable energy is now part of the program. So there's been a few different tweaks like that that have actually expanded the program, made it a little bit easier for you to get credits in New York City. New York City has special rules because, quite frankly, New York City, the New York City area doesn't really need help in development. You know, this most recent version has been an expansion of the program with maybe the exception of the fee that now comes with the program that has ruffled some feathers.
Yeah, it's the interesting thing with the brownfield program is every revision is responding to some level of criticism mm-hmm. that's been out there, because at the end of the day, it is a legislative process.
Sure.
So you have to go through, you know, the legislature to get approval. And, you know, besides just restricting the availability of certain credits in the last, not the latest, but the two prior revisions, the area that was affected most by the revisions was actually New York City and downstate. Mm. And the view was, right or wrong, that a lot of the remediation and sites that were being cleaned up would have happened because of the fact that it's valuable property and people want to remediate in those locations. And more importantly, because of the nature of how the geography is, most of those sites would be digging down to bedrock for remediation, because you have to do that anyways to put in structures. So you generate the most lucrative tax credits in the normal course, and it's in an area that you otherwise would have wanted to do the project anyways. So it really restricted and tightened that to the point that really in New York City now, you need to be in a circumstance where it's affordable housing, it's underutilized, which is a very, very difficult definition to understand. I don't think the department understands what that means. And I can tell you, I've you asked four people, you're gonna get four different answers. But underutilized, and, you know, one other very limited scope of a type of site that's just not being used. Now renewable energy has come in, so that's been added, but really New York City's been restricted, but upstate and in a lot of areas of New York, it's been super helpful. And we're sitting right now in Buffalo, New York, and Buffalo has been a major benefit of the brownfield program. And there's some huge structures here that the tax credits really help to finance and make the viability happen.
And let me just say, I mean, it is definitely, as Mike said, more difficult to get a project into the program as a result of the restrictions in and around New York City, but it still does happen. I mean, we still are working on some pretty significant, prominent developments in and around the city, less, I guess, in Manhattan, but certainly in the surrounding boroughs, there are several developments that we're working on.
Joe, you mentioned the $3.5 billion that's been paid out in credits. Is there any similar tracking with respect to the number of sites that have been cleaned up, or the number of the pieces of new construction or rehabilitated construction that have come about as a result of this?
So there is. I mean, certainly we do presentations throughout the state throughout the year, and anytime a representative from DEC is on there, they have a whole breakdown by region, by costs. So they track all of this very closely. And yes, they've paid out $3.5 billion, but there is 10, 20 times that in terms of the amount of costs that have been paid remediating and developing in the site. So yes, the 3.5 is the payout, but with the state, and that's what we care about, that's what taxpayers care about, developers care about, but the state likes the other number, which is the amount of costs that have been spent, and they track that very closely as well. You know, again, cleaning up property and developing it.
Sure.
And part of the value too here is once you finish the remediation, you have the certificate of completion in hand or the COC, you also have a more valuable piece of land. So you've increased your investment, not just from what you're putting onto the site, but just from ownership of the site. So from a real estate portfolio perspective, it's helpful. And that's one of the reasons why you see kind of a variation of not just, you know, real estate developers doing this, but you see a lot more industrial concerns. Because historically, there's always been a concern about, I don't want to touch a remediated parcel, or I don't want to touch a impacted parcel. Because the concern is, I don't know what I'm getting into. I don't know how expensive it's going to be. That's not my core business. In the last 10 to 12 years, and Joe, I think you've seen the same thing, developers have gotten comfortable with brownfields. In fact, it's to the point now, because of credits and benefits and other economic development tools that different government agencies have, that people are looking for these sites. They want these sites because they're of value. And in areas, you know, like Western New York, which has a long industrial history, it's important to have programs like this that incentivize it, because that's how you get those sites back into useful operation.
Right. I think this is an excellent pivot point to switch from discussing, you know, kind of the history of the program, reasons to participate in it, and talk about how the program actually works. What are the steps for, you know, sounds like an awesome program, but how difficult or easy is it to actually become a participant? You mentioned people are going out and looking for these sites. So my guess is it's not insanely burdensome, but I'm guessing it's not super straightforward either. Yeah.
The interesting thing, when the program started in 2003, it's a brownfield cleanup program, you would think there would be a definition of a brownfield in the legislation and the regulations.
You would hope.
There was not. And so there was confusion as to what actually was a brownfield. And in fact, it became, you know, kind of a, you know, a guessing game sometimes as to whether or not the DEC, who institutes the program, the Department of Environmental Conservation, would support your project. And it needs to be supported both at a local regional level in Albany. And what happened, surprise, surprise, somebody sued over the issue. And it actually was involved Destiny USA, which is the large mall out in Syracuse area.
I'm a Syracuse Law alum, so I'm well aware of Destiny USA. I've eaten at the Cheesecake Factory there on a number of occasions.
Well, I can tell you, your Cheesecake Factory has been remediated, so you're okay.
That's good to know.
But at the time, you know, Destiny USA, the area where they were doing the expansion, there was some low-level hits of certain types of constituents, nothing that the state viewed as being, you know, a detriment to remediating the site or developing the site, I should say. And so they refused to allow the site to go into the brownfield program. In part, I think it was because of the value of the tax credits that would likely flow, although they would never tell you that, but I think there was some aspects of that. So the developer sued, and the developer sued on the construct of there is no specific definition of what is a brownfield, and it should be enough that there's a specter that you would not be able to otherwise get financing or be able to effectuate redevelopment of the site but for the view that it's blighted and impacted. Mm-hmm. And that litigation actually was successful, and the site and the project actually got in. So what happened in the revision to the program back in 2015? They added a definition. You know, at a very high level, what the definition says is you need to have impacts on site that are above state standards. So there's soil, groundwater, there's various types of medias that can apply. You need to have impacts that are documented that exist at the site.
And when you say impacts, what does that mean?
So what it means is something above a level that the state has determined results in improper risk to human health or the environment. So New York State has what they call soil cleanup objectives. Basically what it is it's a prescriptive list of different constituents, you know, petroleum type of contamination, chlorinated solvents, the like, and it gives you a number. And it says if you're above this number, there's a risk. And those risks are tied to the type of use for the property, which, you know, the Brownfield Cleanup Program identifies distinctions between using a property for unrestricted use, which is you could put a daycare at the site, to industrial use, which obviously means you can only do industrial operations at the site because the soil isn't to the level where they feel comfortable telling you it's okay to have a daycare there. Now, people over the years have argued with the department as to their prescriptive, you know, numbers and what those are. But that's how it applies. So when the DEC is considering entrance into the program, you need to have something that's verifiable to show that there's somehow been more than just blighted, it has some level of impact on site.
Let's talk about that application process, because it sounds like you need to go do some research first. You can't just pull up the application and be like, nah, throw my name in the hat and then go find a site. Like, you got to have, sounds like, some numbers and some research that you've done and some site observation. You know, what is the typical process look like for, you know, kind of that stage one, step one of going through this and trying to get admitted into the program?
And I'm a dirt lawyer, so I can talk about dirt. Don't hold that against me. So really what you have to do is there's a process when you're doing environmental diligence or assessment of a property. And ironically enough, it's phase one and phase two. And a phase one is when you're doing a non-intrusive assessment of the property. So you hire a third-party environmental consultant that, consistent with an existing standard, goes out and looks at the site and looks at the history of the site through environmental database reports and other publicly available documents. And they tell you, is there a risk that there's impacts at the site? And if so, does that reach the level that it's known as what's called a recognized environmental condition, or a REC? And I know most people listening to this podcast are probably like, what's a REC? Isn't that like a record or something? It's just basically telling you, you know, that there's a potential or likely probability that the site's been impacted in a certain way. What do you do then? Well, you do what's called a phase two, which, as you would expect, is investigate. So you're doing intrusive investigation, whether that's investing soil, groundwater, or other types of constituents that, you know, I won't bore you with, but it's a whole process. Now, if you want to get into the brownfield program, you want to have phase two data that shows that you're above state standards in some form or fashion. Now, beyond that piece, one of the things that often happens with some of these brownfield sites, especially in municipalities that are forward thinking about this process, there's actually ways that the municipalities can leverage federal dollars under a federal brownfield program to investigate these sites upfront to help market them. So you've created it's not a cottage industry, but it's an economic redevelopment tool by which municipalities will go out and do that work upfront, because project developers often don't want to spend $15,000, $20,000 to see if a site's even going to qualify, because they're looking at what's their capital stack, what's the value of what they're going to get. But if you already have data in hand that says that the site would qualify, you're not spending dollars trying to figure that out up front.
I'm guessing those investigation costs don't go onto the tax credit form.
No, not usually. You have to have a signed contract, basically a signed brownfield cleanup agreement, before the costs start being creditable.
So it sounds like that little, you know, handy dandy municipality goes and investigates it on his own to sell it then to the developers, manufacturers, et cetera, is a pretty great idea.
It is. And when appropriately leveraged, it's been very successful. And you see it in a lot of kind of, in New York State specifically, kind of the industrial, you know, legacy areas where you have, you know, operations that have long since left, and you have municipalities left thinking, how am I going to get somebody to come into this site? You know, they're concerned about the legacy operations. There may not no longer be a viable operator or third party. How do we get somebody there? And you can leverage those dollars as a means to tell Joe, hey, Joe, come on site, check this out. And by the way, if you buy the site, it's going to cost you $500,000 to remediate it, but you're going to gain X number of millions of dollars in tax credits to offset that liability at the end of the day. And a lot of times these sites, because of the nature of what they were historically used, they already have utility hookups. They're close to highways or rail yards or water and different types of modes of transportation. And as the costs of construction continue to go up, it's really if you leverage it the right way, it's very valuable.
So you get your phase two data, you go back to Albany or the DEC and you say, all right, this is the site, I think it's eligible. What do they say?
So what you do is you go through a process, and it's actually well thought out, called a pre-application meeting. You get all your information together and you go sit with local representatives of the DEC. There's 9 regions in the state, so wherever your site's situated, and you explain to them what you know about the site, how it's been potentially impacted, what you plan on doing with the site, and you try and get the region's buy-in. And if the region's on board, then you would go ahead and submit the application to Albany, because central office needs to approve it. And there's a whole timing and process and nuanced aspect of how you go through that, but that's how you would do it. The one thing I'd mention in addition to all of that is the brownfield program, because it is using state tax dollars and credits, it's focused very heavily on citizen participation and public notice. So throughout the process, there's lots of steps where you have to give public notice so third parties and the general public and neighbors are aware of what's going on, one of which is the application process. So if an application is submitted, there's public notice where people in the neighborhood can go and comment on that to make sure that there isn't wide-scale negative thoughts regarding the party looking to develop the site, or there's concerns that maybe the department's not aware of in its decision-making process. But that's up front. And then once you get into the site, then as you determine what the remedy is going to be or the cleanup, there's a whole process by which the public is notified of that as well, so they can give comment to it. Because again, it's a voluntary program. It's not prescriptive with the department telling the parties what the remedy is going to be. It's you're proposing that we're going to remediate it to this standard.
I've watched too much of the show Parks and Recreation, because like for the public comment portion, that's all I can think of is just like going in front of like the 5-member town council and saying, any random thought that comes into their head and being like, do you actually have a comment on this?
Let me ask Mike, you know, just for my own edification, have we worked on a project where the public comment period had really put up a serious roadblock or stopped the development?
Not specifically. I'd say 95% of the time, you know, they get no comments. If they do get a comment, it's something that has nothing to do with the project itself, but is more a general gripe by the community. Now, there are a limited number of types of projects in the state where that has been an issue, but it's more political in nature, tied to the site itself, and the nature of, you know, concerns about from the public perception that you're letting a responsible party who created the contamination into the program, and they're going to generate tax credit dollars, you know, for something they did. And that gets a little bit more political, but most of the time you don't, because people are just happy to see that something's being done at these sites.
Are there any like very famous instances of like the public derailing one of these? Any well-known favorite cases?
Not specifically, because generally speaking, if the department's in favor of pushing it through, a site ends up getting into the program. What you may see, though, is there's an ability under the program, and it's not often utilized, but I have one client that's in the middle of this. The DEC can make a determination that a site constitutes a quote-unquote significant threat. And if it constitutes a significant threat, what that means is you can still qualify for the tax credit dollars, but the DEC gets to pick the final remedy. So you don't get to tell the DEC, I'm just cleaning it up to this standard and I'm only going to do X and Y. They'll tell you, no, 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 we're going to tell you what the final remedy is. Now, they will work with you to understand what the ultimate goal is. But in this instance, with my client, the issue is there was an offsite groundwater contamination plume that impacted residential areas. And so they wanted to make sure that certain work was going to be done. And it hasn't been controversial. And, you know, the client was more than happy to do that and was planning on doing that. But it gives the department the stick in case it needs it to make sure it gets done.
Right. And you mentioned remedies. So let's pivot and talk about that, because that was my next question. I know that there's a part of this process called remedy selection tracks, which is something that I'm unfamiliar with. But I imagine that you are well-versed in the remedy selection tracks and the discretion to choose one or what's recommended, et cetera.
Well, we know that state politicians can count to four because there's four tracks, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Track one is, as you would expect, that's the gold standard. It's you're going to clean up a site to unrestricted use. Track four is the most restricted. What that means probably most for the folks listening to this podcast is the level that you clean it up affects the level of the tax credits for purposes of remediation, which then is used to calculate tangible tax credits. I am not a tax lawyer. I just stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night, but I always defer to Joe when we're talking about the credit allocation, but it really talks about what you're doing on site and how far you're going
to
go.
Right. So people, I imagine, want to do one. One's the gold standard that gets you the best credit, or would you rather spend less and do four?
So there's from a tax credit perspective, it's more of a science than an art, because you don't want to throw good money after bad, meaning cleaning up to a track one standard, if you're really focused on the tax credits, may not be the most advisable approach, because you're going to spend more money to clean up to that level than is worth it for purposes of the credits that you're going to generate and what the use is. So there's a whole process. I would say, more often than not, the cleanup standards you see are more track three and four.
And I'll say I'm usually involved in these projects very early and then very late, meaning that I am involved in, you know, this type of forecasting, structuring, you know, is it, you know, how much are we going to spend? What's the budget? What can we get for that? And then we have spreadsheets that kind of, you know, run the analysis as to, you know, where's the sweet spot for this project, given the full budget for the project, et cetera. So we do all that, and then I'm also involved early in terms of structuring the deal, making sure the tax credits flow the way the parties want it to flow, and that there are no surprises based on the structure of the transaction. But then I basically disappear, and that's where Mike takes over, right? When there's actually remediation being done at the site, you know, I might get a question here or there, is this a creditable cost or something like that? But I largely disappear. But to Mike's point, again, that early part of the work is, you know, we have many ways to analyze it and to make sure that, you're in that sweet spot for the project and for what you're going to be using the site.
Folks, we're going to take a pause here and circle back in part two of this episode. If you're interested in listening to more episodes, we're available on all platforms where podcasts can be found, including YouTube. If you enjoyed this episode of State Tax Talks with Joe Tantillo, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. And if you're in need of a tax professional, you can contact the tax attorneys at Hodgson Russ. Go to www.hodgsonruss.com for more information. And until next time, I'm Joe Tantillo, and this is State Tax Talks. Catch you later, tax fans. The comments contained in this podcast do not constitute legal advice. The opinions herein are the opinions of the speakers and not the official opinion of the Hodgson Russ Law Firm.